From Boomers to Millennials is a modern U.S. history podcast, providing a fresh look at the historic events that shaped current generations of Americans from the mid-1940s to the present day. Welcome to the second of two episodes about the year 1960, aka episode 16, New Trajectories for American Politics and Society. In part one, we examined international relations and defense policies. Here in part two, we will consider domestic political and social developments, including a new phase in the struggle for African-American civil rights. The most famous aspects of the civil rights movement freed African-Americans from oppression by state and local governments, such as the discrimination that kept most Southern blacks from voting, and the policies that banned them from using the same public facilities as white people. However, prohibiting discriminatory behavior by government officials alone was not enough to make life equal for black people in the South. A major part of the Jim Crow system was the common practice of private businesses refusing to serve non-white customers. African Americans even encountered these slights sometimes in the North, where government discrimination was mostly absent, but private discrimination was fairly common and perfectly legal. Being denied service by many businesses created tremendous difficulties for non-white travelers who might be unable to find a restaurant that would serve them food and a hotel that would give them a roof over their heads for a good night's sleep. This problem forced many black travelers to carry a travel guide called the Green Book that identified the businesses willing to serve African Americans. In 1960, a new wave of civil rights sit-ins hoped to eliminate the regular indignity black people faced at the hands of those businesses that valued having an exclusive environment over the principle of serving customers of all races. This topic is still one of the aspects of the civil rights agenda that is surprisingly controversial even today. For example, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky critiqued the component of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that applies to private businesses just 10 years ago. After historic gains for the civil rights movement via the Brown v. Board desegregation decision by the Supreme Court in 1954 and the successful integration efforts of the Montgomery bus boycott in 1956, racial progress seemed to have stalled by the end of the 50s. But a novel tactic soon brought a fresh burst of energy to the civil rights cause at the start of a new decade. It all started when four African-American students at North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro spent several months having regular dorm room discussions about the unfair treatment that black people received in the American South. These young men, named David Richmond, Franklin McCain, Ezell Blair Jr., and Joe McNeil, were fast friends and allies, who are now remembered by history as the Greensboro Four. After extensive consideration and planning, they resolved to do a sit-in at a segregated local department store in order to challenge the racial status quo. Historian James T. Patterson contends that the Greensboro Four got the idea of doing a sit-in from writings circulated by the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, which was a civil rights organization founded in Chicago during 1942. CORE followed the teachings and example of Mahatma Gandhi, the famous Indian independence and peace activist. The organization experimented with a variety of nonviolent resistance tactics during the late 40s, including sit-ins, where CORE members sat down in the opposite section of a segregated facility from the one assigned to their race. However, at that time they had limited success and the tactic was not widely adopted. According to history professor Raymond Arsenault, a harsh McCarthyite political climate coincided with financial difficulties to cause the CORE organization serious problems during the 50s, but it managed to survive into a more promising era for social activism. Arsenault notes that CORE was excited to see Martin Luther King and other leaders of the Montgomery bus boycott, see episode 11, successfully use the types of nonviolent tactics that they had long espoused. CORE then began propagandizing its methods and mobilizing its own aggressive campaign of civil rights protest, which would soon make national headlines as the Corps-sponsored Freedom Rides shook up the South during 1961. But that's a story for our next episode. First, let's return to the four college students in Greensboro, North Carolina, as they set out to use Corps' tactics to spark a civil rights renaissance in the Upper South. The Greensboro branch of the Woolworth's department store had a lunch counter, basically a sit-down diner, that officially served only white patrons. On February 1, 1960, the Greensboro Four entered the Woolworth's, and each man purchased a small item in order to prove that he was a legitimate paying customer. The four then sat down at the lunch counter and asked to be served in the same manner as the white customers. A white waitress reminded them that the lunch counter did not serve quote-unquote colored people, but the students refused to move. According to Patterson, a black dishwasher emerged from the kitchen and told the men that they were being, quote, stupid troublemakers, who were just going to wind up stirring up anger against black people. Nevertheless, the students once again refused to move. A police officer stopped by and tried to intimidate and provoke the young men. They refused to react, but they also still refused to move. It was a standoff, and they remained in place without being served until the store closed down for the day, when they finally left and headed back to campus. On the walk home, they all vowed that they would return to Woolworth's to sit in again the very next day. The four soon learned that news of their courageous demonstration had spread around town. Back at North Carolina A&T, they received an enthusiastic welcome from their fellow students, who praised them for taking a stand against Jim Crow by taking a seat at the lunch counter. Some fellow students volunteered to join them at the sit-in the next day. On February 2nd, the original Greensboro Four were joined by 20 other protesters. In subsequent days, the ranks of black protesters grew, and some pro-segregation counter-protesters began showing up as well. All this made for a tense environment, and regular shoppers began to avoid the downtown Woolworths, much to the frustration of store management. As the sit-in continued for weeks, some white students from nearby colleges began joining the black students in the daily protest. According to historian Raymond Arsenault, the local Greensboro chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, worked to support the sit-in. However, the cautious national leadership of the NAACP refused to endorse the demonstration, fearing that sit-ins were too disruptive and that they might cause white business owners to rally against the civil rights movement. On the other hand, more aggressive anti-racist organizations like CORE promoted and encouraged the Greensboro sit-in, and also worked to organize protests picketing other Woolworth's locations in solidarity. Indeed, positive press for the students' nonviolent protest tactics soon motivated copycat sit-ins to occur outside of Greensboro. According to James T. Patterson, quote, black students were starting to sit in at lunch counters elsewhere in the state. Within a week, the movement had spread across the border to Virginia and South Carolina. A week after that, 54 sit-ins were underway in 15 cities in 9 states across the South. The civil rights movement was now spreading like wildfire. Patterson observes that, quote, black resentments which had somehow failed to ignite between 1957 and 1959 had exploded in early 1960, close quote. Historians James Henretta, David Brody, and Lynn Dumanel report that, quote, by the end of the year, about 50,000 people had participated in sit-ins or other civil rights demonstrations, eventually leading lunch counters to be desegregated in 126 cities throughout the South, close quote. Patterson reports that sit-ins also took place even outside of the former Confederacy during the year 1960. There were protests at racially discriminatory businesses in the states of Illinois, Ohio, and Nevada. The demonstration started with lunch counters, but expanded out to challenge any segregated facilities. Patterson writes that sit-in demonstrations, quote, challenge segregation at parks, pools, beaches, restaurants, churches, libraries, transportation facilities, museums, and art galleries, close quote. The Greensboro, North Carolina sit-in that started it all continued for months. Finally, in July 1960, the local Woolworth's management gave in to the protesters and agreed to integrate the lunch counter. Patterson recounts that the store had already, quote, lost an estimated $200,000 in business due to the disruption from the sit-ins, or about 20% of anticipated sales, close quote. Ultimately, the desire for peaceful and profitable commerce overcame prejudice in Greensboro. Although there was considerable tension and intimidation of protesters, there were relatively few arrests or acts of vigilante violence directed at the participants in this original sit-in. Greensboro, as a relatively large and modern city in the Upper South, was more moderate in its approach to racial separation than some other places in Dixie. At sit-ins in other communities, civil rights protesters sometimes had ketchup poured on them in an attempt to get them to leave their seats. Such attacks were only a preview of the brutality that would occur when civil rights activists tried to crack Jim Crow in the Deep South, as we will see in our next episode. Yet, even sit-ins in the Upper South and in the North were sometimes broken up by local police. Patterson recalls that stores sometimes, quote, summoned police to arrest demonstrators at sit-ins on charges such as trespassing or disturbing the peace. Some 3,000 protesters went to jail in 1960, close quote. Many activists served only short sentences or were released on bail, but while in custody, civil rights protesters often faced unsympathetic or even rough treatment from cops, guards, and inmates. However, the success of many of the sit-ins at desegregating businesses made the hardship seem worthwhile for many protesters. The surviving members of the Greensboro Four to this day express pride in their work as civil rights pioneers, and North Carolina A&T erected a statue in their honor on the college's campus in 2002. Patterson argues that, quote, the sit-ins of 1960 arose, as did the civil rights movement actions in later years, from the collective efforts of unsung local activists. They sprang from the bottom up rather than being orchestrated by forces at the top of society. The quest for equal rights for African Americans brought together a diverse coalition of advocacy groups. The NAACP was the venerable old establishment of the civil rights movement,
which tended to be rather cautious and legalistic. Its attorneys, including Thurgood Marshall, preferred to fight battles in the courts rather than in the streets. The aforementioned core organization was a more militant, northern-based, and secular group that focused its efforts upon coordinating multiracial civil rights protests across the nation. On the other hand, Martin Luther King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or SCLC, founded in 1957, was dominated by Southern black clergymen, but it also generally supported the sit-in movement. SCLC was usually moderate in its rhetoric, but it favored direct grassroots action.
Finally, just to add to this confusing alphabet soup of civil rights organizations, in 1960, the sit-in movement inspired the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, which was an energetic, youthful wing of the civil rights crusade, one that would become more radical than other groups by the late 60s, when it turned toward a black power ideology. It's also important to note that, even during the 1950s, there were some African Americans who rejected a strictly nonviolent resistance strategy. One of these, Robert F. Williams, headed up a local NAACP chapter in Monroe, North Carolina. When black leaders in his community heard about a coming threat from local Ku Klux Klan members during 1957, they armed themselves and exchanged gunfire with the Klan in a skirmish that ended without any major casualties on either side. Williams then wrote a book in 1962 arguing for armed self-defense among black people. Meanwhile, in the North, a black convert to Islam who had been born as Malcolm Little, but who now called himself Malcolm X, was beginning to draw attention with his militant separatist message that encouraged black people to seek independence from whites rather than attempting to integrate with them. These divisions within the early civil rights movement capture the fact that it was not a monolithic effort.
It contained multitudes of factions that agreed that African Americans needed more rights, but they often disagreed over what strategies, tactics, and priorities would best achieve their goals. The increasing demands of the civil rights movement was only one of the many pressing issues that would need to be addressed by the winner of the 1960 U.S. presidential election. The year's contest would prove to be among the most competitive and dramatic presidential races in modern U.S. history. Senator John Fitzgerald Kennedy of Massachusetts, also known as JFK, soon became the leading candidate for the Democratic Party nomination. A full origin story of the Kennedy political dynasty that documents the quirks and characteristics of its members will have to be saved for a future supplemental episode. In this program, we will provide a brief overview of JFK's background. The textbook Liberty, Equality, Power notes that, quote, "A wealthy, politically ambitious father had groomed John F. Kennedy for the White House," close quote. The handsome and wealthy JFK also had the good fortune to attend college at Harvard University, arguably the most elite institution of higher education in the country at the time. Soon after his graduation, the Pearl Harbor attacks brought the USA into World War II, and Kennedy served in the U.S. Navy on a patrol torpedo, or PT, boat in the Pacific. During the war, JFK endured grave dangers, helped to rescue fellow officers, and won military honors. He returned home from war as a decorated veteran determined to start a political career, and with the help of his powerful and influential family, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in the late 1940s. He then captured a Massachusetts U.S. Senate seat in 1952. JFK narrowly fell short in a bid to be the vice presidential nominee on the Democratic ticket in 1956, and by the end of the 50s, the Kennedys had hatched plans to get John to the top of the ticket. According to Henretta, Brody, and Duminil, quote, "Ambitious and hard-driven, Kennedy launched his campaign in 1960 with a platform calling for health care for the elderly, aid to education, urban renewal, expanded military and space programs, and containment of communism abroad," close quote. While Senator John F. Kennedy lacked many major legislative accomplishments, he had plenty of energy, charm, and charisma. Patterson suggests that, quote, "Intellectuals and journalists responded favorably to his dry wit, irreverence, and cool, detached intelligence." And he argues that, quote, "Kennedy was the most charismatic politician of the era, especially to women and younger people," close quote. Historian John M. Murren and his co-authors point out that Kennedy's, quote, 1953 marriage to Jacqueline Bouvier added a special dash of glamour. A favorite of the media, Jackie won plaudits for her good taste, stylish dress, and fluency in several languages, close quote. John Kennedy, whose nickname was Jack, was 43 years old at the time of his presidential run and looks still more youthful, making him potentially the youngest man to serve as president since Teddy Roosevelt took office in 1901. Our listeners who are Gen X or older millennials born during the 80s can perhaps take some comfort in knowing that, in a field like politics, you can be in your 40s and still be considered young. However, probably the biggest novelty involved with JFK's candidacy was not his age but his religious background. The Kennedys were Roman Catholics descended from Irish immigrants, while every previous president in U.S. history had at least nominal Protestant religious heritage. The most controversial denomination to previously be represented in the White House was Unitarianism, a creed adhered to by President William Howard Taft, but that tradition was an unorthodox denomination that at least evolved out of American Protestantism. Having a Catholic president was a much more controversial matter. The USA had mainly been founded and populated until the late 19th century by staunch Protestants from northern European countries such as England, Scotland, the Netherlands, and Germany. For centuries, Catholics and Protestants had been religious arch-rivals, battling for the soul of Christian Europe. In the United States, the Protestants had always been the predominant faction. Despite the arrival by the 20th century of many millions of Catholic immigrants, primarily from Ireland, Italy, and Eastern Europe, a majority of Americans showed voting preferences that kept non-Protestants from reaching the highest levels of national power. The origins of the Protestant-Catholic split during the European Reformation and the theological differences between these religious groups are both beyond the scope of our podcast. Suffice it to say that Catholics and Protestants historically often viewed each other as practicing an inferior or even heretical version of Christianity. In the U.S., suspicion of Catholics emerged in part out of a notion that the Vatican was hostile to democratic government. Most Catholic countries were monarchies up until at least the late 19th century, and some popes, such as Pius IX, had indeed expressed opposition to religious freedom and liberal democracy. However, contrary to what numerous paranoid Protestants believed, in general, American Catholics did not blindly follow every single dictate from the Pope. The vast majority of Catholics in the USA came to believe in democracy, but that wasn't enough to stop the bigotry they often encountered. The fact that many of the first Catholic immigrants to the U.S. were impoverished Irish who worked in low-skill, low-status occupations had also contributed to the traditional disdain that many American Protestants had for them. Before 1960, only one Catholic had been a major party's presidential nominee in American history. That man was New York Governor Al Smith, who in 1928 captured the Democratic Party nomination for the U.S. presidency, but he was then soundly defeated by Republican Herbert Hoover in the general election. Some rural Southern Protestants in the Democratic Party coalition had expressed hostility to Al Smith's candidacy at that time, and his religion certainly cost him votes, which opened up the question of whether a Catholic could ever win the White House. The religious issue presented a major obstacle that John F. Kennedy would need to get past, but he was confident that he had the political skill to do so. The authors of Liberty, Equality, Power argue that JFK's decision to get his campaign off to an early start, quote, along with utilization of a talented staff and his family's vast wealth, helped Kennedy overwhelm his main Democratic challengers, namely Senators Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota and Lyndon Johnson of Texas, close quote. Kennedy also benefited from the fact that, quote, despite chronic health problems, which Kennedy's staff effectively concealed, JFK projected the image of a vigorous, energetic leader, close quote. We will discuss JFK's health problems in an upcoming supplemental episode, but for now the important thing is that the folksy Senators Humphrey and Johnson simply could not compete with Kennedy's ethos of youth sophistication and charisma. His background as a war hero helped Kennedy avoid being labeled as a pampered rich kid and earned him more credibility among blue-collar voters. Like many successful politicians, JFK also gained an edge by being willing to promise the American people perhaps more than he could plausibly deliver for them. He told voters that he would cut taxes to stimulate the economy while simultaneously spending more money on both domestic programs and the military. Kennedy ensured his nomination with his solid victory in the West Virginia Democratic primary, where his main competition was the blue-collar liberal Hubert Humphrey. Patterson writes that Humphrey came to resent the way that he was vastly outspent in that race by JFK. Indeed, personal wealth could provide a candidate with an unearned advantage, even back in the 60s, when wealth was more evenly distributed in the USA than today. In any case, JFK's campaign spending advantage was among the factors that allowed him to prove, via his win in West Virginia, that he could prevail in even one of the most Protestant states in the country. In some northeastern and midwestern states, Kennedy's religion may have been more of an asset than a liability during the primaries, because there were many Irish Americans and other Catholic Democrats in those regions who were excited about having a chance to vote for one of their own. Nevertheless, upon securing the party nomination, Kennedy erred on the side of caution with his selection of a running mate. JFK decided at the Democratic Convention to choose one of his rivals in the primaries as his potential vice president. Kennedy selected Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson, in part because of his rural Southern Protestant background. JFK knew that his Catholicism was still a liability in some corners of the country, and Johnson's presence on the ticket would help the Democrats win the key state of Texas and would reassure Democratic voters in other heavily Protestant states within the American South. So, we have wrapped up the Democrats' presidential primaries, but what about the Republican contest? James Henretta, David Brody, and Lynn Dumanel note that many GOP leaders would have loved to run the still widely admired President Dwight D. Eisenhower for a third term, but Republicans had pushed through the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, establishing presidential term limits just 9 years prior. See Episode 6. That move had been motivated by conservatives' anger over President Franklin D. Roosevelt breaking with American tradition by running for a third term as president. Now it seemed the GOP had their own equivalent of FDR in Ike, an affable and broadly popular leader who appealed to the average American, but they had no choice but to put him out to pasture. Of course, even if Republicans could have nominated Eisenhower to run again, there's a decent chance he would have declined, given his advancing age and his various health problems while president, including a recent heart attack. See Episode 10. Perhaps one reason Ike might have been willing to run again, were it not for the 22nd Amendment, was his pronounced lack of enthusiasm for the other major party candidates in the race, whom he seemed to think were unworthy to fill his presidential shoes. He dismissed Democratic nominee John F. Kennedy as a spoiled rich kid who was far too young and inexperienced to serve in the White House. Eisenhower also remained skeptical of the judgment and leadership skills of the favorite for the Republican nomination, his own vice president, Richard Milhouse Nixon. According to Eisenhower biographer Gene Edward Smith, Ike slighted Nixon by declining to endorse any candidate prior to the 1960 GOP convention. And then when he spoke at the convention, quote, he devoted his entire speech to the accomplishments of the past 8 years and never once mentioned Nixon, although Nixon by that point was the only candidate in the race, close quote. Gene Edward Smith describes the relationship between Eisenhower and Nixon as tepid, and it didn't get any warmer during the year 1960. Nevertheless, Nixon tried to tone down his naturally combative personality and imitate Ike's upbeat, glad-handing campaigning style in hopes of replicating his success. James T. Patterson contends that, quote, Nixon's labored attempts in 1960 to project a more genial persona especially irritated detractors, who thought that he remained a phony, close quote. On the other hand, quote, fellow Republicans admired Nixon's dogged tenacity and partisan spirit, close quote. But Ike didn't think much of Nixon's campaigning. According to Smith, he worried that even the kinder, gentler version of Nixon was still coming across as, quote, too partisan and was driving away the independents and conservative Democrats who had voted for Eisenhower in droves, close quote. Ike also had personal reservations about the conservative Californian. He noticed that the vice president was a transparently power-hungry man who seemed able to make strategic allies, but who had very few real friends. Smith quotes Ike's personal secretary, Ann Whitman, who also was distrustful of Nixon. She said, quote, the president is a man of integrity. He radiates this, and everybody loves and trusts him. But the vice president seems like a man who is acting like a nice man rather than being one, close quote. Obviously, Ann Whitman was biased toward Eisenhower, having spent years working with him. But if she sensed a certain ruthlessness and vindictiveness underneath Nixon's cultivated, cheerful facade, well, subsequent events would prove that she was not exactly wrong about that. Indeed, when we first introduced Richard Nixon back in Episode 4, we discussed the ruthless red-baiting tactics he used at the beginning of his career in 1946 to defeat incumbent Congressman Jerry Voorhees. He then demonstrated his political skills by leading the successful congressional investigation of alleged Soviet spy Alger Hiss in 1948. Nixon then earned the nickname Tricky Dick by running a harshly negative yet victorious campaign for a California U.S. Senate seat in 1950. After using his conservative credentials to get on the Republican ticket as Ike's Veep in 1952, he delivered a clever speech that deftly deflected accusations that he had taken improper political donations. See Episode 7. Nixon was by now justifiably confident in his own political abilities, and he wanted to get out from under Eisenhower's shadow. The Veep reciprocated the outgoing president's lack of enthusiasm for his campaign by doing little to convince Eisenhower to become more involved. Nixon gave the cold shoulder to a chief executive who had never been much of a mentor for him. Smith claims that for the most part, the president's, quote, advice was not sought by Nixon, and when offered, it was rarely heeded, close quote. According to Smith, one piece of advice that Ike did share was that he thought it was a bad idea for Nixon to engage in the famous series of televised debates with Kennedy. Eisenhower believed the vice president had a higher political profile than the young upstart from Massachusetts, and that sharing a stage with the lesser-known Kennedy would seem to put him on the same level with Nixon. Essentially, he worried that the TV debates would give JFK free exposure that could allow the American people to get more comfortable with the idea of voting for him. Smith writes that, quote, Nixon rejected the advice on the grounds that he was a much better debater than Kennedy, close quote. He ended up paying a heavy price for this intellectual arrogance. Historians Henretta, Brody, and Dumanil report that image and charisma may have played a more important role than arguments during the televised debates. Quote, Nixon, far less photogenic than Kennedy, looked sallow and unshaven under the intense studio lights. Polls showed that voters who listened to the first debate on the radio concluded that Nixon had won, but those who viewed it on television judged in Kennedy's favor, close quote. This famous moment in media history certainly was not the sole factor that allowed Kennedy to overtake Nixon in the presidential race, but every small contributing factor would prove important in what turned out to be an incredibly close election. In order to maximize his national appeal, Nixon took a similar approach to Kennedy in selecting a running mate. He also chose someone from the opposite wing of his party in order to ensure a balanced and unified ticket. The conservative Westerner picked former Senator Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., a patrician WASP from the Northeastern moderate Republican faction, as the GOP vice presidential nominee in 1960. This selection was designed to allay concerns that Nixon was to the right of mainstream views in the mid-20th century United States. Emphasizing his service in the Eisenhower administration also helped Nixon position himself in the center. Despite Ike's lack of involvement with his campaign, Nixon nevertheless tried to ride the political coattails of the popular president he had served. Henretta, Brody, and Dumanil note that Nixon, quote, campaigned for an updated version of Eisenhower's policies, close quote. Meanwhile, according to Murren and his co-authors, Kennedy argued that Ike's fiscal policies had been too timid, so he, quote, advocated tax cuts and deficit spending to stimulate the economy. Kennedy also, quote, criticized Eisenhower for failing to rid the Western Hemisphere of Fidel Castro in Cuba and for allowing a missile gap to allegedly develop in the arms race with the Soviet Union. By spending more on defense, Kennedy claimed, he would create a so-called flexible response against communism, especially in the Third World, close quote. Criticizing Eisenhower was risky, given that the ex-general was still widely viewed as an American hero. However, because of the growing unease in the country following the 1958 recession, the Cuban Revolution, and the U-2 incident, Kennedy felt it was safe to attack some of President Eisenhower's policies so long as he always demonstrated personal respect for the man and his many accomplishments. The religion issue remained one of the biggest political obstacles for Kennedy. According to JFK biographer Robert Dallek, the Massachusetts senator's Catholic faith was a concern not only for conservative Protestant Americans, but also for some, quote, progressive Democrats who regarded the church as an authoritarian institution intolerant of ideas at odds with its teachings, close quote. Patterson reports that JFK helped neutralize these concerns by giving an address at a gathering of Protestant clergy in Houston, Texas. In his speech, he declared that in the USA, quote, the separation of church and state is absolute, and he promised in no uncertain terms that he would not let Catholic church leaders tell him what to do as president. He also eventually won over the endorsement of President Truman, who had initially been uneasy with Kennedy's Catholicism. This prejudice was perhaps a result of Truman's small-town Baptist upbringing. Former Secretary of State Dean Acheson, still a trusted Truman advisor, helped to change the ex-president's mind on the issue. According to Walter Isaacson and Evan Thomas, Acheson wrote the following to Truman, quote,
"Do you really care about Jack's being a Catholic? I never have. Furthermore, I don't think he's a very good Catholic."
Indeed, although JFK attended Mass and was proud of his Irish Catholic heritage, he was not a deeply religious man. His wife Jackie once reportedly told a journalist, quote, "It's so unfair of people to be against Jack because he's Catholic. He's such a poor Catholic." It's interesting to note that during the 20th century, reporters seemed concerned that a presidential candidate's religion would unduly interfere with his performance in office. But here in the 21st century, candidates often seem to get more scrutiny for not being religious enough. For example, the current Catholic president here in 2021, Joe Biden, has been criticized by some Catholics and even by conservative Protestants because he has not slavishly followed the doctrines of the Vatican on issues like abortion. Meanwhile, virtually no one has accused Biden of being a puppet of the Pope. One key inflection point of the race between Kennedy and Nixon occurred in October 1960, when Martin Luther King Jr. was sentenced to jail time. According to Robert Dalek, MLK was arrested at a sit-in in an Atlanta department store and then was, quote, sentenced to a 4-month prison term at hard labor for violating his probation on a minor trumped-up traffic violation. King was sent to a rural Georgia prison. His wife, who was 5 months pregnant, feared for his life, close quote. When this made national headlines, Vice President Nixon failed to take action. Senator Kennedy had a mixed record on civil rights up to that point, and he was not known for discussing racial justice issues on the campaign trail. But in this key moment, JFK called Dr. King's wife and offered support. Then his tenacious brother Bobby Kennedy, who was Jack's campaign manager, interceded with the judge and managed to convince him to release Martin Luther King Jr. This rescue of the civil rights leader from legal peril helped to persuade MLK's father, who was also a powerful and influential black pastor, to publicly endorse John F. Kennedy in the presidential race. In the mid-20th century, northern blacks were a key political swing constituency. They had divided their votes fairly evenly between Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson in 1956. The Kennedys' assistance to Martin Luther King Jr., along with Martin Luther King Sr.'s endorsement of JFK, helped the Democratic ticket make significant gains with black voters in the election of November 1960. However, historian Raymond Arsenault notes that the many African Americans who rallied to Kennedy's cause were soon disappointed with the Massachusetts Democrats' lack of interest in civil rights during the first year of his presidency. The Nixon versus Kennedy contest turned out to be a real nail-biter. Henretta Brody and Dumanil report that when all the votes were counted on Election Day, quote, Kennedy won only the narrowest of victories, receiving 49.7% of the popular vote to Nixon's 49.5%. Under 120,000 popular votes separated the two candidates, and the shift of a few thousand votes in key states would have reversed the outcome, close quote. Kennedy narrowly won the White House by reuniting the New Deal coalition of Northern blacks, Southern whites, and so-called white ethnic voters, who were groups such as Irish Catholics, Poles, Jews, and Italians. The Nixon Lodge ticket won a majority of Protestants and did well in the far west, where Nixon's home state of California was his top prize, the lower Midwest, where Ohio was his biggest win, and the upper south, where Republicans won the traditionally Democratic state of Virginia. Meanwhile, JFK captured key heavily populated states in the Northeast, such as Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and New York, and he also triumphed in important Midwestern locales, such as Michigan, Missouri, and Minnesota. The Kennedy-Johnson ticket also dominated the Deep South, narrowly winning LBJ's home state of Texas and losing only Florida to Nixon. Neither major party candidate won in Alabama and Mississippi. Those states went rogue because their political leaders believed that both Kennedy and Nixon were too progressive on civil rights. They instead pledged their electoral votes to segregationist Senator Harry Byrd of Virginia, which was a troubling sign of things to come for Democratic Party liberals. Still, although Nixon won slightly more states than Kennedy overall, the Democrats won most of the big states that had large numbers of electoral votes, which proved to be decisive in 1960. According to Henretta Brodian Duminil, there were some confirmed cases of voting fraud in Illinois during 1960, which helped establish the legend that JFK stole the election. Richard Daley, the Irish-American mayor of Chicago, was a fervent Kennedy supporter who leaned on his powerful political machine to produce votes for the Democrat. JFK biographer Robert Dalek argues that, quote, Daley's machine probably stole Illinois from Nixon, but Jack would have won the national election even without Illinois, close quote. A vast national conspiracy seeking to fraudulently elect Kennedy has never been established, and the widespread pop cultural myth that JFK's presidency was single-handedly rigged into existence by the mafia is unverifiable and is almost certainly wrong. Although the popular vote margin between Nixon and Kennedy was just 0.17%, smaller than even the razor-thin margin for the 2000 election between George W. Bush and Al Gore, it is important to remember what Americans have learned over the past 25 years. It is the Electoral College alone that decides the outcomes of presidential contests. Kennedy won the electoral vote by a score of 303-219, so even if it could be proven that Richard Nixon would have won the 27 electoral votes from Illinois were it not for shenanigans by the Democratic machine in Chicago, JFK still would have defeated him in the Electoral College by a margin of 276-246 electoral votes. According to Murren and Company, quote, many Republicans urged Nixon to challenge Kennedy's triumph in Illinois as fraudulent, but the vice president chose to accept the disputed result, close quote. This concession was one of Nixon's finest hours as a politician, a rare time when he seemingly put the national common good ahead of his own political self-interest.
He congratulated JFK and recognized him as the president-elect, and he didn't do anything crazy like, say, ask Nixon fans to storm the U.S. Capitol and stop Kennedy's inauguration. This was not because Nixon was someone who tended to let bygones be bygones without holding a grudge. He was quite bitter about his defeat in the 1960 election, and he was always a man who nursed grudges.
But Nixon understood the political and ideological climate in the U.S. at mid-century, which in many ways was very different from the atmosphere of bitter partisanship that we live with today. Most American voters back then knew friends and neighbors who had voted for the opposite candidate from themselves, but that didn't seem like any big deal, because both parties were diverse coalitions that weren't all that far apart ideologically. Richard Nixon knew that an attempt to challenge the election results would likely fail, and that doing so would only make him appear to be a fanatical partisan and a sore loser. On the other hand, by behaving with graciousness and dignity, he correctly presumed that if he played his cards right in the upcoming years, he would get another chance at the White House.
Once JFK had secured victory, Patterson notes that, quote, liberals were pleased that Nixon had lost and that the voters had returned Democratic majorities to Capitol Hill, with margins of 65-35 in the Senate and 263-174 in the House, close quote. The Democrats had picked up a limited number of new seats, but the tremendous gains that they had made in the 1958 midterm elections, see episode 13, had remained intact. The big Democratic Party advantage in Congress can be a bit deceptive. It is important to remember that a significant minority of Democrats were conservative Southerners.
Still, there were enough progressive-leaning Dems that they could plausibly partner with moderate to liberal Northeastern Republicans in order to pass reforms that had not been feasible for over a decade.
Whether this alliance would succeed depended upon presidential leadership, and it was unclear how progressive the Kennedy-Johnson administration would be. Although JFK certainly was more left liberal in his plans for domestic spending than Eisenhower and Nixon had been, he was considered more moderate than Hubert Humphrey and other leading lights of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Patterson argues that, quote, Kennedy had run a pragmatic centrist campaign
in which he promised to wage the Cold War more vigorously than ever. There seemed little reason to anticipate that the political center would shift very much in the days to come. Close quote. Furthermore, it appeared that Kennedy's main focus and interest in his first years as president was upon foreign policy challenges, not upon domestic reforms.
Immediately after his victory, JFK began putting together his foreign policy team. He wanted support from the previous generation of Cold Warriors within the Democratic Party, including the so-called Wise Men, that tight-knit group of patrician elites who had guided the Truman administration.
Kennedy held meetings with former Secretary of State Dean Acheson, and he became especially close with former Secretary of Defense Robert Lovett. In their book about the Wise Men, Walter Isaacson and Evan Thomas recall that, quote, John Kennedy had more admiration for the cool toughness and unflinching pragmatism of Lovett and Acheson than he did for his more liberal advisors, whom he considered overly idealistic, close quote. JFK tried to get Lovett to join his cabinet, but the older man declined due to health problems. Lovett recommended that Kennedy select Dean Rusk of Georgia, who was a former protege of George C. Marshall, as his Secretary of State. According to Isaacson and Thomas, quote, Kennedy and Lovett agreed that Ike's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, had been given too much decision-making license by Eisenhower. Kennedy said that he truly wanted to make foreign policy for himself. Then Rusk would be perfect, said Lovett. He was the ideal staff man to serve as a second fiddle, close quote. JFK picked Rusk to helm the State Department, and also upon Lovett's advice, chose a brilliant statistician named Robert McNamara as his Secretary of Defense. McNamara had ably served in World War II and was currently president of the Ford Motor Company.
Journalist David Halberstam famously dubbed Kennedy's team as, quote, the best and the brightest. JFK attempted to staff his administration with tough-minded realists who had powerful intellects and considerable experience serving in America's top institutions. Tragically, this talented group proved unable to keep the United States from entering into multiple international fiascos during the 1960s, above all the Vietnam War. We cannot conclude our 1960 episodes without mentioning an important social development that received less media coverage than civil rights demonstrations and political races, but which nevertheless proved highly consequential. Historian James T. Patterson notes that during the year 1960, the Food and Drug Administration gave its approval to, quote, the sale by prescription of Enovid, the first oral contraceptive for women. This drug became widely known as the birth control pill, and it promised to save women from unwanted pregnancies, and it would serve as a boon for sexual liberation in the United States, close quote. Indeed, the widespread accessibility of the pill eventually spurred new social changes that made the sexual revolution of the mid to late 60s possible. Patterson reports that by the end of 1962, 2.3 million women were using the pill. However, its adoption was gradual, and many local governments still had laws restricting birth control on the books. These would soon be invalidated by a 1965 ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Griswold v. Connecticut, which stated that anti-contraception laws violated the right of married couples to make their own private reproductive decisions.
Still, the social norms emphasizing keeping unmarried young men and women separated until marriage were not going to change overnight. According to Patterson, quote, many institutions tried hard to hold a line. All but a few universities maintained restrictive parietal rules for student housing until the late 60s. Their efforts suggested that parents still expected their children to conform to older norms of sexual behavior. Close quote. Patterson also suggests that the, quote, baby boom did not slow until 1958, after which it declined only gradually through 1964, close quote. Still, the pill eventually had a revolutionary impact on women, providing them with much greater reproductive freedom of choice, which allowed them to set their life plans with less fear of an unexpected pregnancy. This episode has primarily focused upon the seeds of change that would allow the 60s to be fundamentally different from the 50s. But I want to conclude this episode by emphasizing some elements of continuity between the late 50s and early 60s. Some historians identify a block of time that they label the quote-unquote long 1950s, which stretch from 1948 to 1962, from the start of the Cold War to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Indeed, the pace of change remained gradual through the Kennedy presidency, and then quickened dramatically in the period that followed in its aftermath. During the early 60s, youth experimentation with illegal drugs was still relatively rare, rock music remained relatively tame, television was still in black and white, women still generally wore dresses in public, and men usually wore collared shirts and sometimes ties even to baseball games. So, we will not reach the rise of the counterculture and other revolutionary social changes we commonly associate with the 60s for a few more episodes. However, with the revitalization of the civil rights movement, the Democrats' recapture of the White House, and the debut of the birth control pill, the United States has, during 1960, adjusted its historical trajectory and is now fully on course to arrive at the upcoming chaotic era of youth revolt and urban unrest. We will finally reach that destination around 1965. Thank you for joining us on that journey. Please remain seated with seatbelts fastened as we begin our descent into the Vietnam conflict and the anti-war movement. In our next episode, we will foreshadow one key element of late 60s political unrest: the backlash against aggressive U.S. foreign policies in the Third World during the Cold War. JFK entered the presidency determined to establish himself on the world stage as a tough Cold Warrior, but during his first year in office, he encountered many more international obstacles than expected. We will learn how Kennedy's grand plans to defeat the communists struggled to get off the ground in our next full-length episode, as we explore the year 1961. The From Boomers to Millennials podcast is co-produced by Aaron Rodgers and Logan Rodgers. Our show is written and narrated by Logan Rodgers. If you have comments or suggestions about this episode, we would really like to hear from you. Please send us an email at boomer2millennial@outlook.com. Here at From Boomers to Millennials, we know that the real version of the best and the brightest is our listeners, who, unlike Kennedy's team, would never get anyone into a political quagmire or a land war in Asia. So thanks once again for listening.